Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Jump Ball Podcast. My guest today is Sam Vecenie. He's the senior writer at The Athletic, covering college basketball and the draft. He's the host of the Game Theory Podcast. And we're just going to get into the playoffs, a couple of things that, about teams that are currently not in the playoffs, but some interesting stories that have come out this week. And we'll see where we end up. So, you ready to tip it off? Sam, how you doing?
I am doing great, Mo. It is a kind of crappy day out in L.A. here. I'm not super pleased with it, but, you know, it's another day out in paradise, at least the little paradise that we call Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's a little rainy. It's May Day. I don't know where you're located, but I'm in downtown, and I'm fully support of May Day before anybody gets mad at me, but it's also a bit chaotic. A lot of helicopters flying around, a lot of areas you're not allowed to park in, and all sorts of stuff here in downtown right now, which is making the day a bit chaotic for me because I'm in the middle of a move. So I was like, oh, I guess I'm not moving anything today. But that's, you know, neither here nor there. Let's just get into basketball because that's the only thing people really care about. Nobody cares about my personal life or lack thereof.
No, I mean, I tend to care about all this stuff. I find it all very, very interesting to care about podcasters' personal lives. That's the most fun part, is when you can just banter back and forth.
Well, you know what we'll do? We'll do a summer, just the life of a podcaster episode. We'll cover that in the summertime. But we got to get into the playoffs. Look, Boston beat the shit out of Philly last night. Where are you at on the overreaction scale to one game?
Yeah, that's a good question. I thought it would be Boston. I thought it would be Philadelphia in five or six. I did not expect this to even be like a super long series. I would say that the place I'm in is Philadelphia came out super, super flat. They got it taken advantage of defensively a little bit more than what I anticipated coming in. Like, you look at the way that J.J. Redick got kind of torched in that game. Basically, they just kept attacking J.J., whoever he was on. They didn't really have a great game plan to try and stop Jason Tatum. Like, there were way too many possessions where, you know, Marco Bellinelli was guarding him or J.J. Redick was guarding him. Jason, I think, proved in that game that they need to pay more significant defensive attention to him because he's just going to eat otherwise.
Right.
Terry Rozier, you know, I don't think you can expect him to play that well all the time, but they're also going to get Jaylen Brown back at some point too. So that's going to be a really interesting kind of adjustment piece that has to be thrown in for what Philadelphia adjusts to. But, you know, Boston allowed 101 points to this Philadelphia team, and I didn't really think they played all that well defensively. Like, I just think Philly missed shots. Like, they
right.
went 19% from three-point. Like, I don't think that's going to happen going forward.
Yeah, I mean, part of it was Bellinelli had a bad Bellinelli game, you know. And this is, by the way, this type of game from Bellinelli is the reason why I don't think anybody should sign him to long-term deals.
No.
Right. I'm with you on Boston, you know. I don't know how much of it was great defense. I actually thought, despite him having 31 points, I actually thought they did a pretty good job on making Embiid uncomfortable and making him work. I thought, you know, they can defend him one-on-one, I think, with Baines and Horford. But they did a good job kind of getting to JJ a bit better. And the thing for me was, like, I was never on the – for me, when the series started, I said, look, this can go four games or seven games, you know, and I could see Boston even potentially winning it. I still think Philly wins the series. I just think there's still a young group of kids. They're not the youngest team. I think Boston's the younger team, if we did the math and all that fun stuff. But I still think, you know, your main guys are incredibly young that have never been there. And this is a great learning experience for Embiid and for Simmons to learn. You know, like, hey, it gets harder in the next round, and it's going to get harder if they move on and get to the round past that.
Yep.
I don't anticipate them to shoot this poorly. I don't anticipate Boston to shoot that well. It led to the funny story that I told about Aaron Baines and his shooting. and I just kind of like – I feel like both will regress to the mean, you know, or I don't know if you call what Philly did regressing to the mean. I don't speak to
it. Yeah, it is. It's fine.
Okay, fair enough. You know, and I think they'll both kind of come back to the middle, and then I think things will get interesting. I'm very excited for game two because I want to see how Philly responds. I want to see what their attitude's like. You know, you touched on them coming out flat. It's hard when you have a long layoff, you know, and it's harder, I think, for younger guys to understand how they have to keep their flow and rhythm going. And they were hot as soon as the series ended.
Yeah, no, they were very hot coming into the playoffs. They were hot against Miami, and it's going to be good to see how they react to adversity in terms of what happens when shots don't fall, because I actually kind of liked, like you mentioned, I know they gave up 31 points to Joel Embiid, but they made him work for those 31. I loved the way that they defended Ben Simmons mm-hmm. in this game. They really like walled off well and used that shell defense to keep him out of the paint in a pretty significant manner. Now, part of the problem is to do that, you have to have guys who can really recover out to three-point shooters. And I would imagine that at some point, Dario Saric is not going to go 0-4 from three. Robert Covington is not going to go 0-6 from the field. Bellinelli is not going to go 3-9 in every game. And Ersan's not going to go 2-9 in every game.
Yeah, and Covington was terrible, man.
Defensive. He was really bad, and he was bad defensively. Not something that happens.
Yeah, they were bad generally defensively, I think, as a whole. They weren't doing a great job covering, rotating from the weak side and things like that. And it was just like – Brett Brown said it best in his post game. He goes, that game was not indicative of who we are.
Yeah, 100%.
You know, I cut you off when I jumped in on the Covington thing. I hope you didn't lose your train of thought.
No, I didn't. So despite the fact that I like the way that they defended the two stars and – think that that is ultimately what you have to do to be successful in a series like this, I'm just worried that at some point soon Philadelphia's supporting players who have been so good over the course of these last 20 to 25 games, they're eventually going to get off. Like, they're eventually going to be able to score buckets of points and really get going, because Ilyasova, Bellinelli, Saric, Covington, these are all like guys who have the potential to shoot 40% from three in a series. J.J. Redick went 2 of 7 from three last night. He was good in other ways offensively. He attacked closeouts really well. He was good at backdoor cutting, but he still didn't shoot in the way we expect J.J. Redick to shoot. If he starts shooting, and if this team in general starts shooting, I think it's going to be fine. Like, I think they're still okay in this series.
Yeah, I still think they move on. I'm not that worried yet. Now, if they lose on Thursday, then I'm going to start to go, okay, now you got to win four of the next six.
Mm-hmm. Then, yeah, no question.
Then I'm concerned. Then I think, you know, then I'm like, all right, now they have a problem. But, you know, the other thing for me too, even if they lose this series, it's all good development for them. Let's remember what everybody thought this team was going to do at the beginning of the season. You know, if you bet the over, you were betting they were going to win over 41 games. They finished third in the Eastern Conference. They've won a playoff series. You know, we all jumped on the bandwagon, and when I say we all, I just mean in general, that this team can go to the finals. But it's like, hey, maybe they couldn't, but this is a great starting point for the process in that regard. And to me, I think I say the process is over. They've succeeded. They're relevant. That was my big thing about the process. They matter now. And that's kind of it for me with them. You know, any last thoughts you have on the Sixers Celtics series?
Not. I mean, like, I would mention too that, you know, Boston just kind of destroyed them offensively. You mentioned that you thought Philly didn't defend well. I agree with that. I thought that their over-aggressiveness played right into the hands of what Boston and what Brad Stevens want to do. It's going to be interesting to see how they try and adjust to that. Do they start to play a bit less aggressively in coverage? And you know, you brought up the Baines story. Baines was critical for them last night.
Yeah.
He really made Embiid work. He made the two threes, which is great. Smart, I thought, was really good last night, despite the just manner in which he plays, where things are often so negative and then so positive.
Right.
Shimi Ogilvie continues to be really, really useful for them too. If you look at plus minus, you know, obviously Horford, Tatum, and Rozier were all plus 17, plus 18 in that game. But the next guy for them was Ogilvie at plus 11 in 22 minutes. I thought that in his minutes, they really did a great job defensively in walling off Simmons and doing everything that you have to hope a Boston team is going to do defensively in this series. They need to find a way to close down transition, and they need to find a way to keep Ben Simmons out of the paint. They did both in game one.
Yeah, and I think you kind of brought up something that was floating in my head too. Defensively for the Sixers, that's where their transition starts. You know, when they get stops, that's when they're able to run and get going. Yep. So when they struggle defensively like they did, they're easier to defend offensively because they're not flowing and they're not playing with that ridiculous pace and all that fun stuff.
Yeah, no, a lot of what happens with Philly – or no, I'm sorry, not – yeah, with Philly is that they get so helter-skelter that – and they have so many playmakers and shooters that on the early break it can be really hard to match up with them, especially whenever you get into scramble situations where you're trying to cross-match on guys sometimes.
Right.
They cause so many issues with size and shooting ability that it can be often difficult to find matchups that really make sense. So, that's a really critical part too.
Yeah. Let's go to the other Eastern Conference series because this is the one that's really going to be fun, I think. The Toronto Raptors and the Cleveland Cavaliers are going to face off yet again. And for the Raptors, they're facing their old playoff ghosts yet again. We're at another home game one for them. You know, the Cavs are coming off a game seven, which, you know, LeBron had to be superhuman, but this is normal for LeBron. He's had to be superhuman all year. You know, I don't think people give him enough respect in that. I don't know a lot of superstars that could have carried this team to the playoffs.
I think there might be like one other one, maybe. Like maybe not any. He is unbelievable in every way. He is so, so good at leading his team. He can literally do everything on a basketball floor. Even in moments where he has not been very good defensively in this, you know, playoffs, he was, I thought, rough on the ball, particularly when matched up with a Victor Oladipo in the Pacers series. He still just creates so much of an impact as a weak side shot blocker, as a weak side defender in general, that he just creates havoc on that end due to the way that he can speed up what you want to do because you're afraid of when he's coming from behind you. Offensively, he's obviously carrying the load, but this Toronto series is so interesting on so many levels for me just because it's so many polar opposites in this series. Like, you have the superstar-laden team versus the team that gets by with depth. You have the quote-unquote modern Toronto offense now versus a Cleveland offense that can get pretty ugly at times. You know, you have a coach in Dwayne Casey who has just gotten better and better every year, and then you have Ty Lue, who I think is kind of regressing in a lot of ways. And then you just have the idea of a Cavs team that's going to go six deep in this series, essentially, maybe seven deep if they can get a lot from George Hill and something from any of the, you know, Rodney Hood, Larry Nance, Jordan Clarkson lineups, versus a Raptors team that feels good about going 10 to 11 deep. So a lot of really interesting aspects here.
Yeah, you know, for me, it's going to come down to the Raptors are going to have to beat the Cavs by 10 or more. I don't trust the Raptors in close games. You know, we saw it against Washington. You know, yeah, and when you look at their numbers in clutch situations, you know, they had a winning record. They played 44 games. They've won 29 of them. And I think the issue is they have a net rating in clutch situations of a negative 3.4.
Yeah.
Which is just like, okay, how did you win 29 games and have a negative net rating? And I know there's a lot more numbers and fancy stuff that go with that, and I don't need anybody to actually me this later. But it's just interesting to me. Whereas when you look at the Cavs in close games, say what you want. In close games, they win. You know, they're second in the NBA in win percentage. They had 45 of them, you know, clutch situations, and their net rating was like 18 points a game, a plus 18. So for me, it's, you know, if the Raptors let the Cavs kind of hang around, they're going to lose this series. That's what it is to me. You know, if they can come out, put pressure on them early, make LeBron work, which is going to be a hard thing because, you know, who's LeBron going to guard? Like, I'm not worried about I think LeBron's going to be able to steal minutes of rest on the defensive end.
Probably. I mean, it's just a very strange, weird series in a lot of ways. And I think that where you have to start is the Cavs are going to have to get something from George Hill in a significant manner, and they're going to have Kevin Love play well. Because if Kevin Love doesn't play well in the series, it allows Toronto to play guys like Jonas Valanciunas, who I think had a pretty underrated year, to be honest. Right. Like, you still can't really trust him to guard in space, but he does so many other things in terms of rebounding and creating havoc on the boards and, you know, being able to step away a little bit and shoot now and, you know, finishing around the basket and having just the strong center of gravity and ability to carve out position that he does, that if Love doesn't play him off the floor, I think he can create havoc. And I wonder, does Cleveland start two bigs with Tristan Thompson and Kevin Love, or do they decide to play, you know, just the Kevin Love at center lineup so that Jonas struggles immediately and gets played off the floor immediately? There are a lot of really interesting tactical things here that I think are going to make for a really fun series. And then the reason that I think Toronto is in a better spot than most people do is that a lot of people have kind of used their depth as a negative against them, right? Like the idea that they don't have as much, you know, singular star power, so they struggle to get the, you know, production they need from their starting unit. Where depth really helps you in the playoffs is that it allows you to match up with teams in like four different manners, right? Like Toronto can throw out three guard sets of Fred VanVleet and Kyle Lowry and DeLon Wright if they want, or they can throw in just like a one guard set with DeLon Wright where everyone's 6'5" or taller. You know, CJ Miles can play or Norman Powell can play depending on if you want shooting or athleticism. OG Anunoby can play or Pascal Siakam can play if you want a bigger guy in there versus a, you know, stretchy four type. It just allows you a lot of different ways to match up with Cleveland. And if Toronto finds a way to stop that starting lineup of Cleveland, I just wonder what they adjust to. And I wonder right. how they find a way to be successful.
Yeah, that's going to be interesting. I think, you know, if I'm them, with the juice I saw Tristan Thompson play with in Game 7, I think I start him. You know, you want to keep that going for however long you can and keep him feeling good about himself. I think if you move him to the bench, you know, right after that Game 7, you kind of lose any possible good feelings he has. And you know, keeping that, I'm a big fan of just keeping that flow and that juice, and I think that's something that matters. So I think you can. I won't be surprised to see Tristan Thompson start. I'd be worried if you don't, that he loses that a bit. It's going to be interesting because, like you said, Valanciunas, you know, versus Love, like how long can they keep him on the floor? You know, I'm with you on the bench helps the Raptors. I'm with you on that. I'm just more concerned of when things go wrong. I feel like you revert back to who you are, and that's where I'm worried about the Raptors. If they lose Game 1 tonight, man, it's going to be a shitstorm.
Yeah, it is. It absolutely is. The thing with Toronto is it's not even when it goes wrong. It's just when things tighten up. Like, things can be going okay, but in the fourth quarter, as we saw against Washington, they just revert back to that ISO-heavy ball with DeMar DeRozan wanting to take a bunch of shots and Kyle Lowry just looking to attack off the bounce constantly instead of using that heavy ball movement scheme that really worked for them throughout the year. Part of that might be just not having Fred VanVleet to close with throughout a lot of the Washington series.
Right.
Maybe he helps them a lot with just keeping things status quo, keeping things moving on the offensive end. But maybe it's just in their DNA to where they want to just attack. They want to just go ISO one-on-one and get a shot whenever they need one. So I'm fascinated in this. I'm going Toronto. I don't feel great about picking against LeBron, as no one should. Just given the way he played in that series, he was unbelievable. But I just think there are too many ways for Toronto to match up with them. Like, Toronto might have the second, third, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, ninth best players in this series.
But that one is really freaking good.
But the one is really good.
You know, let me ask you this question. OG Anunoby, Pascal Siakam, how do you think they're going to fare in their matchup against LeBron?
Throw as many bodies at him as you can. Yeah. Throw as many different looks at him as you can. Throw Anunoby at him for 6'7 with length. Throw Siakam at him for just a wild motor and playing hard. Throw Norman Powell against him for, you know, lower body strength and ability to really bother you with his hands. It wouldn't surprise me if DeMar DeRozan got some minutes on him, just because that might be the easiest way to match up with him in certain lineup constructions. So I just keep throwing bodies at him. I hope to eventually wear him down, but nobody's going to be successful against LeBron James. Like, you know, Serge Ibaka might get minutes on him too. We have to throw him in there as well. Like, he actually could start on him theoretically if the Cavs play small to start games. So just wear him down. Just make him work for every single thing he does. If he beats you, great. If not, then, and if like Siakam and Anunoby and Ibaka and Powell and everyone they throw at him can make LeBron average 27 points and 8 assists and 8 rebounds on 45% shooting, I think the Raptors win this series. That won't be seen as a LeBron-stopping success, but I think it would be enough to where it would be a success overall for Toronto.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting one. I'm going Cavs, and you highlighted the reason why. I'm just not betting against 23. I don't mind being wrong. You know what? At some point, I'm going to be wrong, but I'm going to keep betting on him until he fails. And I just don't trust the Raptors. I'm sorry. It's just not. I've seen it too many times with them. I just don't trust them. It's you could say they've changed, but you know what? I've heard many women cry about, you know, oh, he's changed, and I've heard guys say the same thing. No, she's changed, and you know what? They haven't changed, and they still end up getting their heart broken. And I'm not ready to. I don't want the Raptors to get my hopes up and then screw me over.
I love this Raptors team. Like, part of it could be that. Like, I really have rooted for this Raptors team all year. I've found them to be such a fun watch. They've done a. I enjoy the way they built their roster as well. They never took a step back. They just kept, you know, gradually adding by evaluating players really well, playing on the margins in free agency, and making timely deals. Like, Masai Ujiri's done a great job, and you know, because of that, I'm kind of rooting for them, and I want them to be successful.
Yeah. And 100% agree with you. Masai, Casey, you know, Lowry and DeRozan changing their games and willing to accept the change and things like that. All phenomenal. Still don't trust those fuckers.
I don't blame you.
Yeah, no. Just sorry. It's a history thing for me. I just don't trust them. Sorry. Sorry, Canada. You know, I love Toronto, great city. You know, would think it's a great story for you guys to make it to the finals. Just don't see it happening. I do want to tell you briefly about my friends at Brand Active Media. They, and you know, I think they're willing to go to Toronto as well. They do a lot of great events. They've worked with the NFL. They've worked with NBA All-Star Games. They were at the NFL Draft, the Super Bowl. They are the group that makes trading cards, makes interactive trading cards. They're the, I don't know, Sam, if you've ever been to a party and there's a photo booth, you know, something at weddings, you know, and you have fun props and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. They do all that amazing stuff. They're great with companies, you know, that they want to kind of promote their brand. You can make a trading card. You can have all sorts of fun stuff and, you know, great environment. This is ads going swimmingly well. The best part about it, though, if you let them know that the Jump Ball sent you, you get to print all of those items for free. So be sure to check out my friends at brandactivemedia.com for any of your corporate or company events, and let them know Mo sent you. That went really well. That wasn't bad at all.
Strong ad read.
Yeah, sure it was. I just make these things up as I go, Sam. let's go to the Western Conference. Tonight, we're recording, you know, like we said, on a Tuesday. I actually forgot what day it was. We have the Golden State.
It's been that kind of week, man. Like, it's only Tuesday, and it's been a long week.
Yeah, right? I feel like it's a Thursday. Warriors take on the Pelicans. They destroyed them in game one. I just came out with a piece today about the Warriors' defense in game one and that crazy 25-9 run they went on from the 7-minute mark of the second quarter. Man, is this series over?
I mean, I'm going to be – it's. I mean, I don't think the Pelicans are going to win.
Right.
I'm at least intrigued enough to keep watching by the addition of Stephen Curry tonight back to the Warriors. I wonder if – and Stephen Curry is incredible. He's fucking amazing basketball, don't get me wrong. But I just wonder if, like, there is a small thing where – Drew Holiday and some of the other guards could get off a little bit offensively in comparison to the way that the Warriors have defended over the course of the playoffs in general so far, where they've played these huge lineups either on the they've always been big on the wings. Sometimes they play a little bit bigger inside. Sometimes they just let Draymond Green and Kevin Durant man the interior. But I'm going to be very interested to see how the addition of Stephen Curry impacts the way that they defend. They obviously know how to defend with him. They've been doing it for years now. I just wonder if it takes a little bit of time on that end.
Yeah, and, you know, the other thing, too, is Kevon Looney was great in game one defensively. Yep. And he's been good all year, but he was phenomenal. He was everywhere they needed him to be. He was switching on to guards. There was... You know, as a team, they did a great job kind of pulling in. Anytime it looked like a Pelican had any open airspace, it was gone in a snap of a finger. That's kind of it. You know, nobody really had the Pelicans winning the series. But I think we might have gotten a little carried away with how good the Pelicans looked in the sweep of the Blazers. And I think, again, that long – same thing for Philly. That long absence of playing and keeping in that playoff attitude hurt them a bit. You know, the longer you go without playing and you don't – you practice in the playoffs, but you don't practice with the same intensity that you play in a playoff game. And it's so much different than a regular season game. You know, the intensity ramps up and everything. And it's just you can't replicate that. So I think, you know, it was like 5 days, 6 days since the Pelicans had swept the Blazers and then played game one. And I wasn't surprised to see them get just completely manhandled. I just felt like they've lost the juice.
I think that it was just a great matchup against Portland because they had guards who could bother Portland and cause issues for them. And the way that Anthony Davis is so capable as a pick-and-roll, pick-and-pop threat caused so many issues with the way that Portland wants to defend conservatively defend by dropping Yusuf Nurkic back into the paint or, you know, just generally kind of filtering teams' offenses into contested shots at the rim or contested shots from, you know, 10 feet away. This matchup is not as good.
Right.
Really, only, you know, the Warriors have so many different ways that they can guard Anthony Davis. They can throw Draymond Green at him. They can play Draymond Green as a rover on a guy like a, you know, Rajon Rondo or a Darius Miller and let him really sag and help situations onto Anthony Davis whenever he dives to the basket and they can tag him. Or they can just play Kevin Durant on him straight up and, you know, be happy with that result. Or they can now play Kevon Looney on him because he's so big and so long that he can at least bother what Anthony Davis wants to do. So they just have so many different ways that they can beat you. Plus, they can throw Andre Iguodala on Drew Holiday, who obviously was one of the 10 best players in the playoffs in the first round, but nobody on Portland could really bother him. Andre Iguodala is going to bother the hell out of him whenever he's on the floor. And their help defense, with all of their length, is going to bother Drew Holiday going toward the basket. It makes it a lot more difficult to really get loose if you're the Pelicans. And I think that this is, for as good of a matchup as the first series was, this one is just as bad.
Yeah, and it's just kind of like the exact opposite sort of situation, right? Like, they just can't compete with these Warriors. I actually think they would have been better off with Boogie Cousins in this series as well. Like, you know, everybody was saying after they swept the Blazers, maybe they don't need Cousins or whatnot. This is why you need Cousins, because the Warriors struggle when you're able to go big against them, you know, and maybe they wouldn't have this year, but, you know, when you're able to add Cousins and AD on the court, then things kind of start to kind of get more difficult. And I get you also, it might hurt Drew Holiday a little bit, but I still think Cousins would have helped big time in this series, and I think that would have made a big difference. Still wouldn't have won the series, but would have made it at least maybe a six-game series versus what's looking like a sweep, maybe five games.
Yep. Yeah, no, I think that's definitely right. The Warriors have had a lot of issues in the past with dealing with DeMarcus Cousins. He's presented so many issues as an inside-out threat that it can be problematic. At the same time, though, it's just that this Pelicans team doesn't really present anything from the wing that can give the Warriors any sort of issues. They don't present anything from breaking you down off the dribble that presents the Warriors help defense with any sort of issues. And that's what makes Houston such a fascinating matchup for them. They kind of present all of those issues that can sometimes get to the Warriors. So we'll see what happens here. I'm really interested in the way this goes.
Yeah, and my last thing, just if the Warriors are going to defend like this with this kind of intensity, it's over.
Yeah, I think that's probably right. I think it would be very, very difficult for them to match that intensity on the offensive end and be able to consistently derive offense throughout the first half of the game, because I think that, you know, the Warriors fell off a little bit late in that game.
Right.
Allowed them to, you know, score. I think they got to like 101 points, but yeah, I mean, it's going to be hard for them to score enough efficiently.
Yeah. Let's go to the other series that was a massive blowout, was the Rockets Jazz. Anything really interesting? I mean, the Rockets did a great job of pulling Gobert away from the rim.
Yeah.
and making it just really difficult for the Jazz. And without Rubio, they're just in such a tough spot. You know, what stands out to you in that series?
Another team with just a bad matchup here, I think. On the plus side, Utah does have some good perimeter defenders, Donovan Mitchell, Royce O'Neal. You know, you can even throw Jay Crowder into that mix sometimes. They have the guys that can cause some issues for the way that the Rockets just want to get to the rim. They just don't have enough shooting. They don't have enough scoring to make up for the math problem, right?
Right.
Like, the math problem is that Houston outscored them by 30 points in the game one from the three-point line. That's a lot that you have to make up going into the interior if you're Utah. And, like, Rudy Gobert is great, but when they play their best lineup features Derek Favors and Rudy Gobert. There's just not enough mobility to be able to deal with what happens whenever these solid perimeter defenders get beat, because every good perimeter defender eventually is going to get beat. It's just really difficult for them to match up with their best lineups. So in that vein, I think that their best bet is to play a little bit smaller, play Jay Crowder, who had a really good game one, at the four, start him, go with Derek Favors off the bench, and just kind of see what happens. But it's a tough, you know, kind of problem to solve for Utah.
The thought I have when it comes to the Rockets, and this would help the Jazz a lot, and this is going to be crazy because, and a lot of people are going to get kind of think I'm stupid, which they wouldn't necessarily be wrong. I honestly think the Rockets are a team that's begging you to zone them. You know, they want you to get into mismatches. They want Gobert switching on to Harden, on to CP, on to Gordon even, you know, and let him create and kind of pull Gobert out. This is one of those things where I think you just got to go zone. It takes you away from the potential of getting mismatches. You have your four perimeter guys on the outside and you're funneling the offense to get into the lane, and that's where Gobert can kind of try to protect the rim and whatnot. But I think, you know, it's something that no NBA team is really going to do, because obviously generally when you zone, it's against bad shooting teams. But I really think against the Rockets, I'm going to do that. I'm going to squeeze in. I'm going to make it so that it's got to be P.J. Tucker, Luke Mbah-a-Mute, Trevor Ariza, whoever else, you know, hitting threes from the corners, because I don't think that's the math game I'm going to play. I don't think they're going to make enough to beat me. And I'm not going to let guys like Harden and CP and even Gordon to an extent get going. So to me, that's kind of my thought with defending the Rockets, is I actually kind of want to go zone and keep Gobert in the middle you know, somewhere at the high post and just kind of work in that way. In that sense, they're not going to do it because they haven't done it all year. Only like two teams have really have shown a zone at all this year, and even then it was pretty limited. But I think that's an area where I think coaches are kind of missing the boat on how to defend the Rockets.
See, I like the idea behind that, but I think that the problem is that the Rockets initiate their offense from so far away from the basket that they kind of reset the way that zone defenses have to run. Like, obviously you're going to run something of like a matchup zone because that's really the only way you can run zone defense in the NBA.
But
right. It's really, really difficult to recover out onto shooters if you're playing 26 feet from the basket. And their guys are so good at knocking down shots from 26 feet away from the basket that I think it's really tough for you to deal with, especially whenever both James Harden and Chris Paul are on the floor. That's the problem, is that they have two guys who can really get into the teeth of the defense consistently, and whenever you start your offense from that far away from the basket, it just makes it geometrically really, really hard to be able to close out with enough control to be able to keep those guys out of the paint. Once they get into the paint, you're just going to automatically collapse because you have to in some way, and it's going to lead to open shot after open shot. It's hard. I like the idea of zoning them to give Trevor Ariza and Luka Mbamute shots, but you're going to have to absolutely find a way to, stop the reversals that happen then.
Yep.
And stop the problems that kind of arise.
Yeah, I mean, it's not easy. It's not going to be an easy thing at all. But I think when you play the Rockets, I think the mistake, is teams try to take away everything. And by doing that, you end up taking away nothing. And I think you have to just select with what you're going to go with. And I'm with you. Zones are going to get stretched out and everything. But to me, any possession, whether the ball goes in or not, with P.J. Tucker and Mbamute or Ariza shooting is a win for me. I want less possessions of Harden, CP, Eric Gordon, getting the shots they want. And that's who I want to lock in on. And I think, that's the mistake most teams make on them. To me, though, my thing is also just for both series. It's just they're not going to be interesting series.
No, they're not. They're not at all.
Yeah. All I want is both teams to come out healthy so that we can get the Warriors-Rockets matchup that we've all been waiting for all year.
Yeah, no, that's what we're all hoping for here. No injuries. Make sure Mbamute is totally 100% healthy, and then we get the the NBA Finals, in my opinion.
Right. One thing I want to bring up is, even though it's a cold day out here in LA, we're coming up on summer, which means it's the perfect weather for low-fat ice cream, and I got the best place for you. I got the best gelato in town. You want ice cream? It's the same thing, guys. It really is kind of the same thing. Can't go wrong with gelato. Uli's Gelateria in downtown LA on Spring Street in between 5th and 6th in the Spring Arcade, and at their second location in the Beverly Grove area on 3rd and Crescent Heights. I highly recommend it. They have amazing flavors. They do a ton of seasonal flavors. I'm a big fan of the Speculoos cookies, and that's not a seasonal one. That is made just so that I can continue to gain weight. And guess what? It's still healthy, guys. I'm not even gaining weight when I eat the Speculoos cookies. You can't go wrong. Uli's Gelateria, whenever you get a chance, I highly recommend you check them out. And for the people that aren't in LA, I'm sorry. That's all I got for Uli's.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds great. I was just down in the Beverly Grove area. A couple days ago, my mom was in town. We stopped at the Beverly Center, hung out. It was great.
Nice. They're in a good location, man. Next time you're in that area, you got to stop in. And next time you're around downtown, I will treat you to gelato.
That is the dream, man. That's absolutely the dream.
There you go. Yeah, you'd be one of the first people to actually get me to pay up. I'm very elusive. I do want to talk about two teams whose seasons have ended, and I want to start with Oklahoma City. And I don't want to jump in on the Russ bandwagon of destroying Russ. I do want to talk about Carmelo Anthony's comments, though. I don't have the exact quote, but basically Carmelo just, made the whole thing of, I sacrificed for the team this year. It didn't work out. I'm basically just going to go be me, was what I took away from the comments. He's scoffed at the idea of coming off the bench. He's opting in, guys. He's going to make the $28 million. And I'm just so concerned for the Thunder. I honestly wish they never made that trade.
Yeah, I get why they did it, but I think that it also caused them a lot of issues in this first round series against Utah. There's just a very real lack of awareness on where his game is at this stage of his career, which is a problem for Oklahoma City going forward. They're obviously going to have to have that contract be opted into. I would imagine that what's happening is he's laying the groundwork for a buyout of some sort.
Right.
Maybe he gets paid $20 million to go away and be able to sign somewhere else and play mellow ball, because that's apparently what he wants to do. He wants to lead his team to an NBA title while playing the style of basketball that we kind of know now he's not capable of leading a team to an NBA title.
Right.
It sucks. It's a terrible catch-22 for Melo at this stage. Everyone around the NBA likes Melo as a dude, thinks he's a generally good person to be around. Like, it's a very tough conversation to have, I think, with an aging superstar who's going to be a Hall of Famer. But it would behoove Oklahoma City to be like, man, we tried this. We tried this that last year. The reason that we weren't as good as we were supposed to be was not because you took a step back. It was because you can't guard anybody anymore. And that makes our defensive culture that we want to build a liability. And we need you to come off the bench and be the guy who kills second units.
Yeah.
Doesn't seem like he's interested in that, though.
Not even. I mean, I was worried in the media day availability start of training camp when he started laughing about the idea of coming off the bench. I said, man, Melo's never going to change. And I like Melo as a person, just the way you described him. You know, Melo as a basketball player, those days are gone, dude. And I equated it to the movie Gladiator and the scene in the beginning when they're about to fight that first battle and then the dude's holding up the head or whatever, and the general turns to Maximus and says, people need to know when they're conquered. And Maximus just looked at him and said, would you? Would I? And I think that's Melo right now. Melo has no idea, just no forethought to the sense of like, hey, dude, it's over, man. Like, my time's done. Like, I'm a bench guy. Him, Wade, all those guys have become bench players, and they can be deadly off the bench. They can add to the years of their careers by being that guy and make more money, which is something that seems to motivate Melo. So I just kind of think this is a poor situation for OKC. If Paul George leaves, I mean, they're just basically fucked.
And you know what the other problem is, too? I think a lot of these guys look around the league and see that LeBron can still play at the ridiculously high level LeBron is playing at, and think, why can't that be me? Why can't I do that?
You know, because they don't put $1 million into their body the way LeBron does.
Well, and like, they're just not genetically capable of doing what LeBron does. Like, LeBron is, I genuinely believe this, that LeBron is the greatest physical athlete that has ever lived on planet Earth. He is just genetically been able to defy aging in such a manner, and obviously it does have to do with the way that he carries his body and the way that he takes care of it, but it's just remarkable to me that he's able to absorb as much contact and as much, just generally having to have the endurance that he has to have to play 40 minutes a night at 6'8", handling the ball constantly, 270 pounds. He's just unbelievable, and I think that seeing those guys who came up with LeBron in the 2003 draft, Dwayne Wade, Carmelo Anthony, they look at him and say, why can't I do that? We're friends. We've been around the block together. We've done this together for years. I should be able to do that. But they can't. And I think it's really, really difficult for them to come around to that idea that their career is on the downside.
Right.
After you've been invincible for so long, because that's essentially what these athletes are. They're invincible in many ways, from regardless of what the scrutiny is media-wise, regardless of what is happening, they carry the ball for their teams for years and get paid $25 million and get endorsement deals and have everyone around them telling them they're great. And, you know, trainers probably help them and tell them negative things to work on and stuff like that. But they're invincible in so many ways. And once you don't become invincible, it takes you longer to recognize that than it takes anyone else.
Yeah, it's also an incredibly hard thing to come to that conclusion, right? Like, you've been playing basketball all your life and to finally give it up.
Yep.
It's or to finally realize you're not what you used to be. The feelings of aging is just not fun for an athlete, and it's something that most of us really won't ever experience.
Yeah, Carmelo Anthony, you know, I just talked about this invincibility, you know, of a guy. Carmelo Anthony has been invincible since he was, 14 years old?
Yeah.
Something like that. Like, he was at Oak Hill Academy basically immediately. He was the best player basically wherever he wanted to be. Well, he was like at Oak Hill, what? I thought he was at Oak Hill from like his junior year onward maybe. And like he was at just his local high school for, you know, a couple years and was dominant there. And he was like a top three prospect in the country throughout his entire life and for his age group. It's impossible to come down from that now. Like, Carmelo Anthony is still one of probably the five best players in the world, who is 30, what is he, 34
yeah.
now?
Yeah.
Like, he's still one of the five best 34-year-olds in the world, but one of the five best 34-year-olds in the world is no longer one of the best 100 basketball players in the world.
Yeah, and that's just a tough break in that sense. And I'm very curious what Oklahoma City does. I mean, I'm sure they would love a buyout. and in that sense, but I just don't think they're gonna get there. And man, if they don't re-sign Paul George, this is gonna get ugly very quickly for the Thunder. The other team I want to talk about, you know, Ramona Shelburne and Michael C. Wright dropped a great piece on ESPN on the Kawhi Leonard situation with some really interesting nuggets. You know, one, talking about the actual medical injury and the disagreement that the Spurs and Kawhi's group is having on. If you can't come to an agreement on what the actual injury is, it's extremely hard to come up with how you're going to treat it. And then there's another great nugget in there about his group itself and the inner workings there. I know you read it. What was your takeaways from that piece?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of kind of speculation in there about his group maybe trying to get him to a big market. There's speculation in there about the way that, you know, he's trying to hang out for a long-term contract extension. We just don't know in so many different avenues of this thing because... And this is something that you've heard for the last couple of years from agents around the league and everything like that, that his situation in terms of representation and in terms of who his circle is, it's drastically changed, and they don't really talk about it. And it has, you know, Brian Elfus and Mitch Frankel split from Impact. I don't even know if what Frankel still runs is considered Impact or what.
Right.
Apparently, like, according to this article, what happened, like, I guess that Kawhi is theoretically being represented by his uncle or something like that, and Frankel is a consultant. Is that what they're referring to?
That's how it was written up in the article. But I think the paperwork had not his uncle listed as his agent.
It's something weird. And it's unlike anything for a superstar in professional sports, by the way.
It's almost like it feels kind of LeVar Ballish.
Well, the closest analog I thought of was Kristaps Porzingis and Giannis, his brother.
Mm-hmm.
Giannis kind of runs the show for Porzingis. And the thing about that is, though, that Giannis was heavily involved from the time that Kristaps came over to America and has now gotten certification to be an official agent. Like, he is, right. an agent who also represents other clients now too for You First. Like he's a very real.
He's an actual player. Agent. He's an actual agent.
Whereas it seems like Kawhi's uncle is just the dude that's there who Kawhi trusts, and you know, God love him. From the article, the uncle really stepped up when Kawhi's father passed away, and that's fantastic. Like, I don't mean to crap on the guy by any stretch of the imagination, but it's just a situation that is unique among superstars in professional sports, and I don't know what to make of it.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. It is still so secretive in so many ways in terms of what they're trying to accomplish with Kawhi.
Yeah, it's not, you know, and again, like you said, like his uncle really stepped up, you know, with the passing of his father. And then, you know, there's clearly a trust and a bond between the two of them. But that doesn't necessarily mean that he should be the decision maker. I think that's something that he should be definitely involved in your process and all of that and however you want to help handle it. I'm always scared of the wrong person making the decisions, you know, and I think that's kind of a big issue with the situation is like the Spurs aren't sure of the motives of Kawhi's group. They're not sure of what's going on, you know, and it's awkward when it's like, he's my agent, but he doesn't have any other clients, and so I'm not sure what he's. You know, I'm really all he is. It's, you know, this isn't Jerry Maguire. You know, who in the movie had a bunch started out as a big time agent and then just ended up with one client. So I think, you know, it's kind of a difficult. It's a really just interesting and crazy thing for me. My stance has always been, you know, until the Spurs either don't offer the $219 million extension or until Kawhi absolutely says, I'm not going to sign any $2 million extension, I just don't see him. I don't see them parting ways. And that's speculative. And that's speculative on my end. But that's just too much money. Like, you're crazy to pass that up.
Yeah, I agree. Wholeheartedly agree. It is. What can he get offered? He can get offered like 4 years, 150 or like 155 or something, if I remember correctly.
Well, I've done the math, so and that's rare in my case. But if he were to demand a trade and wherever he gets traded to, he can sign an extension with that team for 4 years, $180 million. If he stays one more year and leaves as a free agent and goes for another team, he could sign for 4 years, $140 million. And maybe my math is questionable, maybe not, but from my research, that's what I saw. And listen, from 219 to even if you just sign for 180, that's, you're still leaving $40 million on the table.
Yeah, that's a lot of money to leave on the table.
And you're uncertain of your current health status. You haven't played for a year. Like, nine games isn't, you haven't played really in a long time. You might want to just get the most you can get. And there's always the argument of, well, you can make more money with sponsors and marketing elsewhere. I kind of want to fight that. I don't think Russell Westbrook is losing out on marketing dollars by playing in OKC. He's all over the place.
Yeah, and, you know, I think Kawhi, if he wanted to play that game, could be all over the place, much in the same way that Russ is. Like, Russ doesn't even like to play the game. Like, Russ hates dealing with media, but he does endorsements. He has his fashion thing. He gets his name out there in different ways. Kawhi just doesn't seem like he wants to deal with any of it.
Right.
And that's where the problem is. Like, if he wants to be a, you know, a guy who's getting all these endorsements and thinks he deserves it, he's got to put himself out there. Like, he has to actually be out there and be in commercials and be dealing with the media constantly. That's what LeBron does. LeBron is so good at keeping himself in the news because he constantly talks to the media. He talks to them about the smallest things, about the biggest things. He makes himself available for pregame availability a lot of the time, like
right.
When stars don't. Like, there's just ways to do it, and he just doesn't do it that way.
Right. So I kind of fight the idea that the marketing dollars are better elsewhere, because everybody knows who Kawhi is at this point. You know, and believe me, if they didn't before this season, with this whole crazy saga, they sure as hell know now.
Yeah.
You know, and maybe it's not good publicity, but it's publicity. And I honestly don't think the Spurs issues are with Kawhi himself. I think it's more just a group. And I'm really fascinated to see how this whole summer will go down. I mean, granted, the Spurs also have a lot of weird issues. You know, Tony Parker's a free agent. They got to find out what happens with Manu if he decides to come back. And, you know, the Pop situation, you know, unfortunate, you know, passing of his wife and having to figure out what does Pop want to do? You know, what it could be crazy in San Antonio. They could lose all their assistants to coaching jobs. Pop could retire. Tony could move to another team. Manu could retire and Kawhi could demand a trade.
Yeah, I don't know what's going to happen there. I have no idea.
I mean, that's
the most fascinating like situation in the NBA to me right now is the Spurs.
For the most secretive organization, that's just like the weirdest situation for them to be in. But it is what it is there. Sam, I think we've gone long enough here. What are you working on? What do you want to plug?
I'll be writing about a bunch of prospects over the course of the NBA draft process. I'll be doing that over at The Athletic, and I have my podcast, the Game Theory Podcast. So please go subscribe to that on whatever podcasting platform you use. Also hit the subscribe button on Mo's Jump Ball Podcast. That helps him out.
Hey, thanks, Sam. Most people don't plug my stuff in their minute to plug their own stuff. Thank you, man. I appreciate that.
Always here to help.
Sam, thanks so much for coming on. That's it today. Be sure to rate us, like us, leave reviews on iTunes, Google Play, SoundCloud, Stitcher, wherever else you go to listen to your podcast. You can also support us on Patreon.com. Have a good one.